financial crisis. She also opened the German borders to refugees during the 2015 migrant crisis, letting in almost 1 million people to the country. The German chancellor had a rocky relationship with former US President Donald Trump. The two clashed over several issues, including the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, funding the NATO, and Trump's so-called Muslim ban on immigrants. Merkel's critics, however, have called her out on her immigration policy, her inaction toward the climate crisis, and her government's COVID-19 restrictions.
And instead of stopping the wars, Merkel simply intensified them by accepting the educated people from those countries, the skilled people from those countries, which deprived the Southwest Asia and North Africa of its most needed middle class, and dumped a load of people into Europe that had no real connection to the continent and had no linguistic or religious or any kind of cultural ties. And the destruction of the European community continues apace as a result of her actions.
Merkel will remain the country's interim chancellor until a new coalition is formed and the parliament votes for a new leader. Her departure marks the end of an era for the European country.
Retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is the former Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who emerged as a leading critic of the neoconservatives. Neoconservatives are characterized by their support of hawkish foreign policies. In remarks to Mass Peace Action last June, he made some brazen assertions about Israel.
I said the other day Israel will not be a state in 20 years. It'll be gone. It certainly will not be a democracy. It'll be an apartheid state, and the world will just reject it, as they did South Africa. But I'm now saying it probably won't be a state. It'll be gone.
He pointed to the 1946 Joint Chiefs of Staff to a State War Navy Coordinating Committee, noting that then U.S. President Harry Truman was trying at the time to decide whether to recognize Israel in 1947-48 and what to do about U.S. policy. Wilkerson said, Israel is a strategic liability of the first order for the United States, and the chances are very high it would drag Washington's feet into a full-fledged face-off.
Israel is the most likely state in the world to take the United States to Armageddon. And I could paint you all sorts of ways we would do that and the ways we would get there.
The retired general also revealed that during 40 years of military service, he had heard constant advice from everyone not to establish an American military base in the Israeli-occupied territories. He stressed that the United States standing with Israel against half of the world is not a good thing. The Israeli regime, he said, needs to be reined, but that would not happen.
Israel, I think, needs to be reined in, and it needs to be told in no uncertain terms, you will change, and you will change swiftly and effectively, or you can count your sugar daddy gone. Yeah, not going to happen. Not going to happen.
In fact, Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel for decades through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes.
Well, I certainly think that that's a possibility. I do agree that it is delegitimizing itself, even in the eyes of many Jews around the world, especially young Jews, which is going to make it hard, of course, for Israel to reproduce itself. And yes, I think it's being considered more and more a worldwide pariah.
Wilkerson has said that the obsession of U.S. neoconservatives, particularly former Vice President Dick Cheney and former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, is to plunge the entire Middle East region into chaos and to keep Israel's enemies at each other's throats so that they could not unite and give Israel trouble, militarily or otherwise. Wilkerson also pointed out that it does not matter for neoconservatives to target Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, or Iran in their pursuit to set the region on fire, as the important thing for them is to protect Israel. However, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the Axis of Resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The latest sign of this assertion is the U.S. House of Representatives' decision to pass a bill to provide $1 billion of additional funding to replenish Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system, despite the regime's blatant violation of Palestinian human rights.
In recent decades, the United States has increasingly used sanctions as an instrument of foreign policy. There are different types of sanctions, economic or financial restrictions, trade prohibitions, and blocking or seizing assets of individuals, organizations, and countries. Now, a coalition of North American human rights organizations, named the Sanctions Kill Coalition, has released a report on the impacts of the U.S. sanctions on other countries and their people. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter. The report has also revealed a bitter reality that Western media rarely or never talk about. One finding is that U.S. sanctions are hurting the most vulnerable and driving middle-class citizens into poverty. Also, they have resulted in thousands of deaths and humanitarian exemptions. For instance, U.S. sanctions on the Syrian Central Bank have collapsed the country's currency, sending millions of civilians into grinding poverty. Also, waiving sanctions by the U.S. undermine countries' capacity to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, resulting in loss of lives. The inhumane sanctions cause difficulty for countries like Iran to obtain medical supplies, sanitation equipment, and other necessary goods to slow the virus spread. Therefore, the U.S. contributed to many unnecessary deaths in Iran.
So we've actually known for 100 years, at least a century, what the impact is. The impact is primarily felt by the civilian population, and it is devastating.
The report also says many U.S. sanctions are based on false claims of an emergency and a threat to national security. The 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York. World leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern, including rejecting inhumane sanctions. During his speech at the United Nations General Assembly, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro called for the lifting of sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union on his country.
We ratify our request. Our demand to the United States and the European Union governments lift all the criminal sanctions against the Venezuelan economy, against the Venezuelan society. We say it with the reason and morality that we have, and we say it on behalf of 30 million Venezuelans.
Maduro denounced what he called permanent systematic aggression waged against Venezuela through these restrictions and called for the establishment of a new world free of colonialism and imperialism. Also, Cuban President Díaz-Canel lashed out at the U.S. administration of Joe Biden for intensifying, quote, the cruelest economic blockade ever imposed against any nation.
The U.S. government has not for 1 minute ceased its attacks on Cuba. But at this crucial and challenging moment for all nations, its aggressiveness exceeds all limits. The cruelest and most prolonged economic, commercial, and financial blockade ever applied against any nation has been opportunistically and criminally intensified in the midst of the pandemic.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, the Cuban president said, "The U.S. is extorting sovereign states to act against countries it identifies as adversaries." He said the U.S. presses its allies to build coalitions to overthrow legitimate governments. Western media has failed, or maybe wanted to fail, to inform the public about the consequences and global condemnation of U.S. sanctions. Most U.S. citizens are unaware of the severe harm being done to millions of residents of countries such as Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Iran.
It's a primary foreign policy tool that the U.S. government uses in order to weaken and decimate countries that it has disputes with. It should be considered a crime against humanity. The kind of sanctions against a country, against a whole people or a whole nation, should be considered a crime against humanity because the effects are horrible.
exacerbating the suffering of civilians in different countries during a severe health crisis such as the coronavirus pandemic, is morally corrupt and a clear disregard for basic human rights. This is what U.S. sanctions have done. The U.S. may be quick to deny this, but deep down it wants sanctions to provoke the populations to rise against the government in the hopes of regime change in the respective countries, something it has for the most part failed to achieve.
After days of controversy, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a $1 billion bill to fund Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile system. American lawmakers approved the bill in a 420-9 vote on Thursday. The push had appeared in a bill on Tuesday aimed at providing emergency funding to the U.S. government to avoid a shutdown, but was later removed without explanation. The removal was attributed to opposition from a small group of Democrats who demand the U.S. support for Israel be based on the regime's human rights record. The exclusion of the provision, however, drew strong reactions from Republicans and pro-Israeli Democrats, with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham calling the move despicable.
The progressive movement in Congress consists of maybe, less than 10% of the Congress. So they have very little power, and furthermore, the progressives in Congress don't often use their power. They're intimidated a lot of times into going along with the rest of it. So we can't expect very much from the progressives.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett thanked both parties in the House for their support, adding that those who tried to challenge the U.S. support for Israel got a resounding response. The bill is now heading to the Senate, where it's highly likely to be approved, as American politicians from both political camps have traditionally backed Israel. It's also expected to be signed into law by President Joe Biden, who has already signaled support for the additional aid. Pro-Israel American lawmakers have been pushing for additional funds to Israel to replenish the regime's missile system since the most recent war on Gaza ended in a ceasefire earlier this year. The truce stopped the 11-day conflict in May, the most intense fighting between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel in years. Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing the show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. The sheer scale of the attacks overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system. The war killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children in Gaza and 12 people in Israel. That's a significant number, considering the regime's heavy expenditure on anti-missile systems, while the resistance in the impoverished and besieged Gaza Strip has no means of shooting down Israel's missiles.
From the point of view of justice, there's no reason not for Palestinians not to have an Iron Dome system. But obviously, that's not what Israel wants at all. Israel wants to be able to hit Palestinians, to cause misery and destruction and death to Palestinians whenever they feel like it.
The move by Washington to increase aid to Israel comes despite calls by some U.S. politicians and activists to cut fundings to pressure the regime into respecting Palestinians' rights. With all that said, the reversal of the move to include the additional aid to Israel in the U.S. government spending budget suggests that Washington's unwavering support for the regime is beginning to falter, as no U.S. lawmaker would hesitate to approve more funding for Israel a few years ago.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Health tourism. In the name of God, salam, and welcome to the 11th program in our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to take you to the city of Yazd in Iran and introduce you to Shahid Sadoughi Hospital in this central Iranian city. Please stay tuned. We have once again come to the city of Yazd to get more acquainted with the tourist areas of this city and also get familiar with one of the city's well-known hospitals, which also operates in the field of health tourism. The city of Yazd is located between the Shirkuh and Kharagnak mountains in a wide plain called the Yazd-Ardakan Plain. Some geographers attribute the date of construction of Yazd to Yazdgerd I, the Sassanid king. But in the Atabakan ruling period, which was one of the feudal dynasties in this region, the city of Yazd developed significantly. Preserving its historical identity, the city of Yazd has become one of the most beautiful cities in Iran today. Historic buildings and monuments abound in the city, and traditional markets and bazaars situated in the old part of the city are all among recreational and tourist attractions of the city of Yazd. The historic city of Yazd includes various old neighborhoods, but among all of them, Fahadan neighborhood is one of the oldest. In this historic city, you can still find many houses belonging to Ilkhanate, that is Ilkhani period, and to the Qajar period. These traditional old-style houses almost invariably feature a central courtyard, a hall, three-door and five-door rooms, high walls, beautiful decoration inside the house, picturesque surroundings, and it is interesting that these old houses are still residential and people live in them. Preserving the traditional and historic structure of the city of Yazd has attracted many domestic and foreign tourists to this city. Therefore, a large number of traditional houses in Yazd have been transformed and refurbished into residences suitable for tourists. In fact, tourists can become acquainted with the lifestyle of the people of this city by staying in these refurbished houses. These traditional residences are mostly located in the old part of Yazd. The city of Yazd, steeped in history, is able to attract many foreign tourists with its fascinating places to visit. But the city has also taken significant steps in the field of health tourism for several years and is trying to be successful in attracting health tourists as well. Health tourism is currently one of the most popular kinds of tourism, which in addition to providing health services, will also boost other areas of tourism, such as hotels, transportation, and other sectors of the economy. In the following, we will further discuss the emerging and successful health tourism industry in Yazd. Stay with us. As mentioned earlier, the city of Yazd has taken some valuable steps in the field of health tourism in recent years. and is trying to use its urban and historical attractions, as well as improving its medical infrastructure, to attract even more health tourists. Currently, there are 14 public hospitals in Yazd, with 1,582 beds, and 7 private hospitals with 983 beds that are offering a range of medical services to patients. Yazd is a leading city in several medical fields, such as infertility treatment, cardiovascular disease, dentistry, gynecology, treatment of cancer and diabetes. Several hospitals in Yazd have successfully obtained International Patients Department Permit, that is IPD, in the field of medical tourism for the treatment of foreign patients. One of these hospitals is Shahid Saruqi Hospital, which also accepts foreign patients after receiving its license. Located in southeast part of Yazd in the Safoye district, Shahid Saruqi Hospital was inaugurated in 2001. The hospital is housed in a modern building with a combination of international standards and Iranian architectural art. This hospital is built on a plot of land measuring 50 hectares, and 45,000 square meters of medical space has been built on 5 floors. This modern and well-equipped hospital is known as the largest governmental educational medical and research center in central and southeastern Iran. The hospital has 1,600 personnel, of which 200 doctors and 600 nurses offer medical services to patients. Shahid Saruqi Hospital has succeeded to receive a national first degree accreditation certificate and also has an International Patients Department IPD, which has made this hospital one of the best medical centers in Yazd. Shahid Saruqi Hospital consists of different wards, including inpatient ward, paraclinic ward, and emergency ward. Each of them provides different services to patients. The women's ward of the hospital has 30 beds, and all its rooms are fully equipped with medical equipment, as well as a TV, refrigerator, and a sofa to cater for the patient and anyone accompanying him or her, as well as a nurse call system. The operating rooms of the hospital also include two sections of general surgery and gynecological surgery. In the general ward, there are 13 operating beds and 34 recovery beds. And in the gynecology ward, there are 3 operating beds and 5 recovery beds. Having this number of surgical beds makes it possible to perform several operations at the same time. The International Patient Ward of the hospital is located on the ground floor, and the reception, treatment, and hospitalization services for foreign patients are provided in this ward. The doctors of the IPD department of the hospital are among the best specialists and super specialists who are in charge of all the medical affairs of the foreign patients. Foreign patients are referred to the relevant doctors in the shortest possible time after being admitted to this ward and providing required documents, and the treatment process begins afterwards. In the case of the need for hospitalization or surgery, the follow-ups will be carried out by the international ward personnel. Due to the potentials and capacities in the city of Yazd, especially the successful records in the field of in vitro fertilization or IVF, or infertility treatment founded by Professor Aflatunian in Yazd many years ago, many patients come to this city for infertility treatment. Shahid Saruqi Hospital in Yazd has expressed readiness for various kinds of treatments due to these potentials and enjoying from super specialty departments and doctors. The hospital is also trying to promote the hospital through media and tourism companies, and to upgrade its position in order to attract more medical tourists. Dear listeners, that was the 11th episode of the series Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Some major international humanitarian agencies are warning about the consequences of the economic crisis in Afghanistan due to widespread joblessness, poverty, and U.S. sanctions on the country. Either war or unemployment has forced Hamid and hundreds of other families to flee their homes and get to Kabul in search of a better life. But contrary to their expectations, they are living here in this camp in northern Kabul for the internally displaced. They are living dire conditions and deprived of basic services.
We left our village in Baghlan province after the escalation of clashes back in July. Now we are living here while we have no access to our basic needs, such as portable water, electricity, or healthcare services. Hundreds of people here are suffering from malnutrition as well.
Abdullah is another internally displaced man who also lives here with his family members. He says nor the Taliban, neither humanitarian aid agencies have so far met their needs. Therefore, he asks for implementation of a transparent supporting plan for people like himself and the rest of vulnerable Afghans who are suffering from hunger and malnutrition.
Humanitarian aid should be distributed among the neediest families like us, but so far, we have seen that most of those who are in charge of handing out humanitarian assistance are corrupt figures because they usually distribute the aid among their own relatives and friends.
Under such circumstances, the Taliban administration has also called on the international community and humanitarian aid agencies to resume their aid supplies to Afghanistan. This comes as some neighboring countries of Afghanistan, like Iran and Pakistan, have begun sending humanitarian aid to Kabul, a move that is widely welcomed by both the Taliban and ordinary Afghans, especially the internally displaced ones.
A rise in the number of internally displaced people has put pressure on Afghanistan. Moreover, Afghans are already denied access to their assets, as Washington has frozen them under the name of slapping sanctions on the Taliban. However, facts on the ground show that Washington's move has affected the lives of ordinary Afghans, especially internally displaced people, rather than affecting the Taliban. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Russia has warned NATO against setting up military infrastructure in Ukraine. It comes after Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said the United States is creating military bases in Ukraine under the guise of establishing training centers. Lukashenko said he has discussed the issue with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, and they agreed to take action to counter the growing NATO activity.
It's actions that will provide further strategic interests and security of our two allied states. The issue of potential expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was numerously mentioned by President Putin, and President Putin said it was beyond the red line he had talked about repeatedly.
Moscow has time and again warned against NATO's expansion in Ukraine, saying it is a red line the West will regret crossing. Last week, Russia held large-scale joint military drills with Belarus. The maneuvers followed Ukraine's joint war games with the U.S. and other NATO member states. Tensions have been simmering between Moscow and Kiev since the ouster of Ukraine's elected president Viktor Yanukovych in a U.S.-backed revolt in 2014. The tensions further escalated after Crimea declared autonomy from Ukraine to reunite with the Russian Federation. The so-called revolution in Ukraine and Kiev's subsequent reach out to NATO could be part of a puzzle being pieced together by the United States and its allies to contain Russia militarily.
Emin Izhar condemned what the Iraqi government has described as an illegal meeting held in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The meeting demanded Baghdad join the so-called Abraham Accords and normalize ties with Israel.
We believe in the rights of the Palestinian people to liberate their land, and therefore we will stand against any attempt to normalize relations with Israel. The recent illegal meeting in the Iraqi city of Erbil is completely rejected. It's a desperate attempt after the failure of the so-called deal of the century. Palestine will be liberated and Israelis will be expelled.
Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour slammed the meeting, saying it is an attempt to drag the free people of Iraq to normalize relations with the Israeli regime, adding, those who have normalized ties with Israel are part of the Zionist project in the region.
The normalization meeting that was held in Erbil, Iraq, is an attempt to drag the Iraqi people into normalization with the Israeli enemy and for Iraq to become part of the Zionist project, as some Arab rulers did last year. But the conference failed and was rejected by all the free and resistance forces in Iraq because it is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause and the Islamic nation.
The so-called Abraham Accords is a U.S.-led Middle East initiative aimed at establishing diplomatic relations and full normalization between Arab countries and the Israeli regime. This agreement was signed by Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Sudan, and was welcomed by Israeli officials.
Yemenis have praised the Iraqi government's rejection of normalization of ties with Israel. They say the free people of the world will always support the Palestinian cause until the liberation of the occupied territories. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki is the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria known as the IMN. The top Muslim cleric and his supporters have been subject to a crackdown by Nigerian authorities over the past years. The most brutal attack took place in December 2015 in the northern city of Zaria, Kaduna State. The army opened fire on Zakzaki's supporters, killing hundreds, including three of his sons. The military accused the sheikh's supporters of having tried to stop the passing convoy of the army chief to assassinate him. The IMN vehemently denied that accusation. During the crackdown, Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife suffered gunfire wounds. They were taken into custody under the pretext of protecting them from violence in Zaria. But they were later charged with culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, and disruption of public peace, among other things. A year later, the Abuja High Court ordered their release, but the Nigerian government defied the order. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife remained in prison until July 28th this year, when they were released after a Kaduna High Court dismissed all charges against them. The IMN welcomed the ruling, saying it is a victory of perseverance in the face of extreme persecution. Kaduna state officials later acknowledged in a report that the military had acted disproportionately in connection with Sheikh Zakzaki and the Zaria massacre, and that the soldiers involved should be punished. No one has so far been prosecuted over the incident.
British government considering sending in army personnel in an effort to alleviate the fuel crisis that has seen back-to-back queues or empty forecourts across the UK over the past days. Drivers across the capital especially have been involved in a desperate game of trying to beat their neighbour to a petrol station that was still lucky enough to have some fuel left.
I basically just ran out of fuel, and but I've been trying several of them, and then everyone just been shutting down. So it's quite bad, really. You know, I mean, I never thought, you know, I mean, we're going to run out of fuel. I thought maybe one day we're going to run out of food, but another field.
This morning, we are supposed to have a delivery. Because due to shortage of drivers, we couldn't get a delivery. It has been postponed till tonight now. To be honest with you, since the Brexit, this thing has happened, like, you know? A lot of drivers have gone back home, like, and hence, there is a sort of shortage in the haulage industry.
It's empty forecourts like these that will no doubt be causing political anxiety for the government. But none will be more stressed than the British consumer, who might be wondering where might they get the next full tank in order to make it to school, to make it to work, to make it through the day.
The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, is keen to describe this not as a crisis exacerbated by Brexit, but one manufactured by the haulier industry, who says they need over 100,000 extra drivers to meet current need. There's also been a degree of blame placed at the feet of the consumers for panic buying and driving up demand unnecessarily.
There's no shortage of the fuel within the country. So the most important thing is actually that if people carry on as they normally would and fill up their cars when they normally would, then you won't have queues and you won't have shortages at the pump either.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already announced a three-month visa scheme to tempt experienced EU HGV drivers back to the UK to assist until Christmas, and the role the army could play is also being explored.
We are bringing MOD trainers in to accelerate some of the HGV training. We've to clear a backlog of people who want to carry out those tests, so there's definitely a role there for the MOD.
In the meantime, consumers want to guarantee that they are not left stranded, and if that means driving miles in search of the precious fuel, it's a journey they're willing to make. Amina Taylor, London.
A latest study by the National Farmers Association called Diretti has found that difficulties in trade with the UK could put 3.6 billion euros worth of Made in Italy agri-food exports at risk. Italy's agri-food exports into the UK have already decreased by over 2% since Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed a Brexit trade deal with the EU back in December. Experts say the drop is a direct consequence of Brexit.
From January 1st, Brexit has introduced more bureaucracy, more tax, and a completely new and complex regulatory environment, which have greatly affected the trade volume between the UK and the EU. It must be said that our agri-food products have suffered a drop in trading revenue in Britain only.
The UK ranks fourth among Italy's food and beverage trading partners after Germany, France and the US. Pasta, tomato derivatives, cheese and dairy products are the main Italian export items to the UK.
Among other Italian products exported to Britain are transport, clothing, machinery and appliances and metals. Trade volume between the two countries stood at about 35 billion euros in 2020, but due to red tape and new tariffs, many are concerned it might drop significantly in the coming months.
We knew full well that Brexit would have had serious consequences. Having said that, Italy's production system is strong. Our high-quality agri-food products are in great demand.
Coldiretti has also expressed concern over the decision by Downing Street to move away from European food standards. This way, Britain risks being flooded with cheaply produced or counterfeit food and drinks. Max Civili, Rome.
As Afghans witness their most difficult days amid the collapse of government and newly settlement of Taliban's emirate, Islamic Republic of Iran delivers its third round of medical and food aids to Afghanistan. This Iranian plane carrying humanitarian aid arrived at Kabul airport on Saturday, containing several tons of rice and other basic food products.
The plane that you see here has brought Iranian aids containing 15 tons of food products. We are here to sort out the aid supplies. We thank neighboring countries that help us in this critical situation and stand by our side after the withdrawal of the U.S. forces.
Due to bazaar shortage and increasing prices of food and medical goods, Afghans in major cities and villages demand humanitarian aids, Furthermore, they're concerned about their assets being frozen by the U.S.
We are in a critical situation. Public assets, including our salaries, have been blocked and most of us have lost our jobs. We demand neighboring countries to provide us with humanitarian aid.
Afghanistan's economy, which depends on foreign aid, suffered a big loss in the recent change of government. The people of Afghanistan look forward to receiving international aid, calling for an end to sanctions on Afghanistan as soon as possible. They believe that blocking the assets of Afghans by U.S. government puts the people under pressure rather than the Taliban. The United Nations has warned of a looming food crisis in Afghanistan. The UN has also said that its food stocks in the country could run out by the end of September, further pushing millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A number of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers during military raids into different areas in Jenin and northwest of Al-Quds. Three Palestinians were killed near the towns of Beit Anan and Biddu northwest of Al-Quds. The Israeli military said its forces had been tracking a Hamas movement cell for several days and had conducted a wave of operations against the movement across the West Bank and killed Ahmad Zahran, Mahmoud Ahmedan, and Zakaria Badwan, all from Biddu town.
We were shocked by the martyrdom of a number of our sons. We say their blood will pave the way for the Palestinians to go ahead with their fight against the occupation. This is only one part of the Zionist violation against our people.
In the village of Burqin, southwest of Jenin, 16-year-old Yusuf Sabah was killed during the clashes and his body was confiscated by the Israeli forces. 22-year-old Osama Subah was another Palestinian from Burqin killed by Israeli forces. He succumbed to his injuries in a hospital in the city. Palestinian Islamic Jihad later endorsed him as a group member and threatened that black days await Israel in the West Bank and its crimes will only intensify the movement's resistance and unity. Thousands took part in his funeral procession. His wedding was planned for next month, his father told us.
We received the news with utter shock and immense sadness, but no objection. It's Allah's will. Osama's wedding was supposed to be next month, but he was chosen to be martyred.
Two Israeli soldiers were seriously injured during the clashes that broke out between Palestinians and Israeli forces. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett issued a statement backing the military's operation.
Palestinians say Israel uses lethal force to stem anti-regime resistance in the occupied territories. But they say Tel Aviv will fail to intimidate them into giving up their struggle. Muna Qandil, Occupy Jamallah.
September 26 marks the International Day of Solidarity with Palestinian Journalists, initially declared by the International Federation of Journalists in 1996. To this end, Palestinians held a sit-in rally in front of the house of the journalist Yusuf Abu Hussein, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes during the last escalation in the Gaza Strip.
Yusuf has been targeted inside his home. Israeli regime intends to target journalists in an attempt to hide the truth of this inhuman regime from being delivered to the world. This is totally against international law to target civilians.
There are 24 Palestinian journalists inside Israeli jails, including a female journalist. There are also a huge number of journalists that were injured and others killed while doing their work.
Palestinian journalists and media outlets have always been a direct target of the Israeli regime. Hundreds of journalists have been killed or injured while covering the Israeli crimes in Gaza.
This is a stand to express our support and loyalty to our colleagues who have been killed or arrested by the Israeli regime for only covering the truth. This event is held to highlight that we won't allow the international community to ignore the Israeli crimes committed against journalists. During the last escalation, we lost Yusuf, 35 media institutions were bombed and more than 12 journalists were injured.
Palestinians called on the international media organizations to show solidarity with Palestinian journalists and take steps to provide them with security.
During the recent escalation of unrest in Gaza, the Israeli regime has intentionally targeted Palestinian journalists and destroyed several media offices in a bid to block the truth. Palestinians here call on the international community to provide protection and security for journalists and hold Israel accountable for committing atrocities against them. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
This is the second time that the aircraft that belongs to Iran's Mahan Airlines lands here in Kabul International Airport since the beginning of September to deliver tons of humanitarian aids to war-weary Afghans who are experiencing difficult days due to poverty and joblessness.
This is the second time that we have brought some food for the Afghani people. Before the previous time, it was about 25 pounds. 20 tons of food and 5 tons of medicine. This time it is all food.
The flow of humanitarian aid by Iran to Afghanistan is welcomed by all in Afghanistan, saying their country needs more assistance to save the lives of millions of ordinary people who are at risk of hunger and malnutrition. They also believe there must be a transparent process to distribute the aids to most needy ones.
Given that poverty and joblessness are on the rise in Afghanistan, I think it would be better for donors to first provide food and then pay serious attention to the healthcare sector.
We have been receiving international aid since 2001 during the rule of Karzai and Ghani over Afghanistan, but all to no avail, because poverty is still bothering our people. So my suggestion is that these aids must be distributed first among the most vulnerable, poor and jobless people.
Iran has pledged to continue its support to Afghanistan and its people in different economic, humanitarian, political and security fields. This comes as Taliban took over and met a guest, suddenly changed the situation in Afghanistan, and of course, it also brought some major changes in the policies of some Western states, mainly the U.S. toward Afghanistan, such as freezing Afghanistan's assets. The freeze of Afghanistan's reserves by the U.S. is labeled as an illegal move by Washington against ordinary people. That is why Afghans widely condemn the move and ask why ordinary Afghans should pay the price of Washington's defeat in Afghanistan. However, Afghans look to supportive stances and moves of some neighboring countries like Iran as an example of honesty and true cooperation with Afghans. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thousands of people took to the streets in Damascus to mark Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. Mourners from Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Bahrain walked their way from different parts of Damascus to Sayyida Zainab Shrine, the sister of Imam Hussein, to mark the occasion.
We came walking from Sayyida Ruqayya Shrine to Sayyida Zainab. We don't care about terrorism or takfirism. We will every year mark this day and renew devotion to Imam Hussein and Sayyida Zainab. We learn patience and faith, courage and sacrifice from them.
Whatever we do, it's nothing compared to the sacrifices of Imam Hussein. We came on foot from our homes to express condolences to Sayyida Zainab on her brother's martyrdom.
Wearing black clothes, visitors flocked demonstrating the events that took place on the day Imam Hussein was killed by the tyrant of his time, Yazid. They chanted slogans expressing condolences and love to the Imam, as well as devotion to remain adherent to the principles of Imam Hussein, who sacrificed his life to confront injustice, tyranny, and oppression.
Our message to all those who love Imam Hussein is that the Waqf of the captives will remain alive in our memory. We are representing today what happened on Ashura to revive the events that happened that day.
The significance of commemorating Arba'in at Sayyida Zainab Shrine is the fact that she was a symbol of resistance after her brother's martyrdom in the face of enemies. The shrine was also a target of the oppressors of our time, the US-backed terrorists. The sacrifices of resistance fighters, however, kept it secured.
Syrian Muslims have never failed to mark Arba'een in holy shrines, even at such critical times as the coronavirus pandemic. Their attendance here is a message of adherence to resistance against injustice at all times and a reiteration of their commitment to the path of Imam Hussein. Hamad Ali from Sayyida Zainab, Damascus Countryside.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
February 27th, 2021. A leader in the true sense of the word. You see how Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, carried out her duties towards her husband. Hazrat Zahra and the commander of the faithful, peace be upon him, were married for about 9 years during the 10 years of the Prophet's presence in Medina. It is said that small and large-scale battles took place during these 9 years, and the commander of the faithful, peace be upon him, was present in most of them. How strong a person needs to be able to prepare this husband to empty his heart of the temptations of family and the troubles of life, to encourage him and to raise their children as well as she did. She is the daughter of the magnanimous leader of Islam and the powerful ruler of the time. She had many suitors. There were rich and well-known men among those suitors, but God had chosen Ali for Fatima from among all those suitors, and Fatima was satisfied with this divine choice. She lived with the commander of the faithful, peace be upon him, in such a way that Imam Ali alayhi salam felt satisfied with her, with all his being. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah. In the Abu Talib Valley, the Prophet was alone. There was no one to comfort him, and everyone was taking refuge in him. But who could remove the dust of sorrow from his face? It was Khadija for a time, but she is gone now. It was Abu Talib for a time, but he is gone. In such a difficult situation during the 3 years in the Abu Talib Valley, which was one of the hardest times in the life of the Prophet, this daughter was like an angel of salvation for the Prophet. She was like a mother for her father. She was like a great nurse for that great man. She endured the hardships. She was a comfort to the Prophet. The personality of pure Fatima Zahra, in political and social dimensions and in great struggles, was a distinguished, outstanding personality. Her life was such that all women who were fighters, revolutionary, leading, and political throughout the world can learn from her short, significant life.
In the limelight.
Critics say Britain's Labour leader Keir Starmer has hijacked the recent gathering by getting bogged down in voting issues and losing sight of a focus on policy. We're prepared for you an article written by Toby Helm. The piece is titled Infighting Mars Start of Labour Conference as Starmer and Rayner Clash Over Voting Rules in UK. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. When Angela Rayner, Labour's deputy leader, stood up to huge cheers to address her party's conference on Saturday, 25th of September, the slogan Stronger Future Together was projected on the big screen behind her and all around the vast hall. Before what had been billed as Keir Starmer's defining conference, when he would reveal the real Keir to the nation, the party leader had also spoken recently of the need for togetherness in the party in a 35-page pamphlet spelling out his vision for Britain. Keir Starmer wrote, "In recent decades, the legacy of the 1997 Labour government has become contested to the extent that the party has at times felt like separate families living under one roof. This has been harmful and alienating." But before most delegates had even arrived in Brighton, hopes of Keir Starmer's party hanging together for 4 days by the seaside and focusing on attacking the Tories as they struggled to deal with the threat of fuel shortages and empty shelves in supermarkets had been horribly shattered. Before Angela Rayner's speech, her friends were briefing that she was furious with Keir Starmer. The deputy leader, they said, was enraged that her boss had allowed the start of the annual gathering, potentially the second last before a general election, to be hijacked by an unnecessary row over changes to rules on how future leaders should be elected, to which she was opposed. Angela Rayner had to spend much of Saturday morning, when she should have been preparing for a big conference moment, holed up in an emergency meeting of the National Executive Committee in Brighton's Hilton Hotel, trying to amend Keir Starmer's plans into an acceptable form and forge compromises on other rule changes with the unions. A source said she was against Keir Starmer's main plan, adding, but she also had to try to broker some deal before the whole party fell apart. She was very cross because she had spent months talking to the unions about the serious economic plans we wanted to launch at the conference, only for them to be buried in the media under coverage of this mess. On Saturday, 25th of September, the centrepiece of Keir Starmer's plan to weaken